accession number 19060, Reel 5.
Jim Murray, Reel 5.
No, you wouldn't get a direct answer from a Kikuyu person. You would dodge about a bit. It would take quite a long time to get to what he was trying to say.
Was that because they didn't trust you, or was it because of just their style?
It's their culture. It's their culture, yeah. It's their style.
So, were most of your police duties in this area, in Miyangi, was it mostly anti-Mau Mau, or was it general law and order?
It was mainly general law and order. We were right at the front. You couldn't get any further up the front line, sort of thing. We were right in among it. We knew the native people, the Kikuyu people there, were staking sheep and cows by the forest edge, so that the Mau Mau could come and take them to feed themselves, you know, and things of that nature. People Mau Mau were coming in and seeing families and whatnot. We were trying to catch them. We were patrolling, trying to catch them, but there you were like animals at that stage. They travel like the wind.
What do you think the attitude of the average Kikuyu person in your area was towards the Mau Mau?
Well, I don't think the average one were very keen on them at all. They were terrified of them. I mean, it was all to do with witchcraft, really, and really black witchcraft. I mean, the oath-taking ceremonies was terrible. And one of my main jobs was, which a regular thing this was, they used to do circumcision ceremonies on the River Gura. And the ceremony was always conducted by the witch doctor, the local witch doctor. And the procedure was to have plenty of maize beer on the riverbank. Male and female people who were waiting for circumcision, there could be 9 or 10, 11, would be stood waist deep in the river. And the mountain river Gura is quite a cold river. And all night long they'd stand there. And the chief and the witch doctor or whatever, all be sitting there, all the dignitaries there, sitting boozing all night. And then at dawn, the circumcision was actually done with an old skinning knife or something like that, where the clitoris was just cut off bluntly. And most of the injuries that we took to hospital was with the female, where the vagina had swollen right up and it was in a terrible state. And that's when they came. So we used to try and catch them before to disperse them before they did the ceremony. And it was terror. We used to take them by Land Rover down to Nairi, the hospital at Nairi. And it saved their lives. But the thing is, they were mutilated. All these young girls were mutilated because there's a way of doing it. And it's still being done up in London with them. So, but it's done with a proper, without bluntly hacking something away. And this is what they did with these young girls.
And was all this illegal?
Oh, it was illegal, but I was telling this fellow, I worked for the Bank of England, and we were reading the papers one Sunday, and I was telling this fellow that it still goes on, this circumcision, even in this present day. No, a load of rubbish, he said. But in actual fact, it was in the paper, it said, where people were still doing it, upcountry. The girls had to be done. And it's absolutely terrible.
Were there any other tribes apart from Kikuyu in your area?
Not in that area. They were all Kikuyu. But there's also, I can't remember, the Kipsigi tribesmen. We used to have them in the police, a lot of them in the police. Well, they're the great runners, Kiptano and Kiptanui. Usually all the Kipsigis people, the name starts with Kip, for some reason or other. All the Kipsigi people, the name seems to start with Kip.
What kind of policeman did they make?
Very good, and trustworthy and honest.
Were they any different from the Kikuyu?
Oh yeah, the Kikuyu were very too good for their. They were too clever. They were, the thing is, they thought they were cleverer than the Mzungu. I think they believed that, you know, they tended to be a bit sly, the Kikuyu people. But in there again, I think a lot of that is their way. That's the way they like to sit down and have a conference that lasts for something like 3 blooming days or something like that. But for the short time I was there, I mean, I didn't really get into the way of things, you know.
And how were the Kikuyu regarded by the other Kenyans?
Well, they weren't very well. Like even now, I mean, they've been treated not too good, actually. Maybe they didn't like the European, but they had a better deal, I think, with the European than what they get from the Kikuyu or the. The majority, from the Kikuyu, the majority party now in Kenya, you see. Arap Moi he was a Mau Mau. He was definitely a Mau Mau, and he and his henchmen are running the country to the way they like it.
So how long were you with the Kenya police?
I was only there over a year. The emergency ended with the capture of Dayton Kamathi. Princess Margaret came out there, and that was regarded as the end of the emergency when she came out, you know. And then they didn't want those 3-year men. We were 3-year contract men, and they didn't really need us then. And they'd accept us on a regular basis. But they didn't want contract men anymore. They wanted us out then. So I came home.
Did you like your time in Kenya?
I loved it. I loved the country.
Did they have to give you some kind of severance payment?
Yeah, well, it was quite a bit. I think I got 6 months. 6 months leave with pay, and I think we're averaging about. Well, I was averaging about £8 or £10 a week at home. I think I was getting about £20-odd a week there. And I was living off the land. The rivers were full of trout. The Gura River, you could catch a dozen trout before breakfast.
Did you feel at all unsafe whilst you were there?
Never. Yeah, I was the only white man for miles and miles around. But I always felt confident in myself. I think I could look after myself wherever I was, you know. I always felt that way. And I mean, I had good weapons. I'd also had an armoury there full of weapons. I was always armed.
But could not some hostile person have murdered you in your sleep?
Oh yeah, if they could have got in. But I was, I had guards patrolling all night, and there was barbed wire fence 6 foot high, right round, or 8 foot high, and then there was animal pit, we call it an animal trench sort of thing, full of panjis, which are sharpened bamboo canes, you know. Because the elephants came through one night, they didn't get over the barrier, but they were outside, they knocked all the trees down and messed about with a few of the huts. But there were herds of elephants and lions and all that.
Would you have British troops coming to your area?
We weren't allowed in our area.
Why not?
Well, it was... Funny thing, the police didn't. Police and the army didn't get on. They reckoned that when the army moved in, the Mau Mau would just move out. They could hear them miles away. They make too much noise. They had to be lightly weighted. They had to be special troops to catch Mau Mau. They had to be lightly weighted. They had to have trackers and every blooming thing. You couldn't catch Mau Mau otherwise, you know.
What happened to you next?
Well, I came home from Kenya and got a job as a bulldozer driver and dumper driver for the National Coal Board.
Is this County Durham?
In County Durham, yeah. And I'd been there for a while and I was driving a dumper and there was a 6 foot rake, 7-8 steel bar buried in the road. And the dumper wheel caught it, and it flew up and struck me in the eye, fractured my skull. And I was conscious until I got to Newcastle Hospital, and then I went unconscious for 3 weeks. I was in a coma for 3 weeks. And when I came out, I had no eyebrow and really despondent and that. And as soon as I got myself pulled together, one day I found myself outside the recruiting office at Durham again. And inside was a bloke, the recruiting sergeant was a bloke I was in Korea with. Billy George, he was a machine gun sergeant. And he says, get yourself back in, the terms is good, and you'll have a better life inside, you know, back in the army. I says, well, who would let me in with an eye like this? Oh, he says, I'll take you to a doctor who will not even see that. So I went and talked it over with my wife. She says, well, it's up to you. I says, well, there'll be a home for you there. Because by then we had our own house, little terrace house in the Pitt village of West Cornwall. And we had one child and one on the way. And she says, you do what you think. So I went back, saw this doctor. Sure enough, he must have been in his 80s. And all he said was cough. Didn't see me eye. And so I was back in, and they wouldn't let us sign on for 22 because I'd already done 3. So they said, we'll let you sign on for 12, which I later got converted to complete 22. So I signed on for 12, and same routine. I joined the Brandsmith again. I had to learn the 7.62 rifle, which had come in while I was out, and the Sterling, which had took over from the Patchett, which was similar, anyhow, it was no problem. And then went to Germany again. This was 1961.
So you rejoined in 61?
61, yeah. Went back to Berlin again.
And you're back in the DLI?
Back in the DLI.
Did they just have one battalion then?
Yes, just the one battalion. They did form a one while we were in Korea, the 2nd Battalion, but after the Korean War, they disbanded it again. And as I say, I joined the battalion in Berlin, and that was the year the wall went up. So I was there when the wall went up in Berlin.
What are your memories of that?
Well, it was hectic because the call-outs were called Rockenhorse. So if you heard the word Rockenhorse, you knew that that was a turnout, and or the Geordies call them Rocky Horse. And we used to have to take up positions down on the By the Brandenburg Gate, in the Tier Garden, just outside the Brandenburg Gate, and we had have a lot of kit in the Olympic Stadium that there, especially explosives and shaped charges for blowing the bridges in Berlin, you know, because I was back in the Salt Pioneers as well. Then they sent me to Chatham. From Berlin, I was only a Lance Corporal. I made Lance Corporal in a few months, and they sent me to Chatham to do a B2 Assault Engineers course.
Do you remember anything about the erection of the wall?
No, it more or less went up overnight, sort of thing. It was so quick and going up, you know. And so that was it. It was just very hectic. There was regular calls out. We were there on hand, but nothing really out of the ordinary for us anyhow.
So you didn't feel a world war was going to break out?
No, we didn't think that.
Sorry, you said you went to Chatham?
Yeah, so I couldn't understand why, because I was new to the platoon again, you know, and maybe because I'd had previous experience of mines and demolitions and booby traps. But they decided to send me to Chatham, and the RSM, who I'd never known, I'd never done him any harm, he says, well, if he goes to Chatham and on a warrant officers and sergeants course, and he's only a Lance Corporal, he'll not get the stripes on his arm until he leaves. He'll have to take the stripes home, get his wife to stitch them on. He says, and when he comes back, regardless of what grade he gets on the course, A, B or C, he'll take his stripes off at home and come in as Lance Corporal as he does before. So what he thought that fella had for me, I don't know. I'd never got on the wrong side of him. I've never known him before. And so that's what I did. I bring the stripes home and asked my wife to stitch them on, and then I went to Chatham and did the course, and complete. I got a C, which is a regular pass. If you're at A, they normally keep you as an instructor. But I came back home, took my stripes off, went back in as a Lance Corporal. And while he was the RSM, I never made sergeant. But when he left, when we went to Hong Kong, I finally got my sergeant's rank. That was 3 years passed in that time.
So this is about 64?
That was 63 when we got there, 63. Yeah, so we got to Hong Kong, and they disbanded our platoon, the Assault Pioneers, and transferred a section to different rifle companies. But then I was promoted to sergeant to take over the reconnaissance platoon to get them fit for Borneo, which I did. And prior to leaving Hong Kong for Borneo, I was asked to reform the Assault Pioneer Platoon. So I had to recall the Assault Pioneers that I had before and reform a platoon and hand over reconnaissance platoon to another sergeant. And one of our first jobs in Borneo was attached to the Gurkha rifles, and we had to prepare a new defensive camp 3 miles further on than where they were, at a little village called Bucket Knuckle, and which we did. We spent 6 weeks with them, and to start the first week we lived with them prior to moving up to this new camp, and was curry every day, breakfast, dinner and tea.
With the Gurkhas.
With the Gurkhas. And a few feathers in with them as well. we did a good job up there, and the battalion was still in a training camp in Sabah at the time. We were in Sarawak, and they were still in Sabah.
What kind of work were you doing with the Gurkhas?
Well, they were the infantry there, but we were actually using explosive and chopping trees down, and blowing trees down, digging defensive positions, putting water supply on, and all that sort of thing. Everything that I'd been taught by the Royal Engineers in Chatham, I was putting it to good use, and water purification and all that sort of thing.
So why was a DLI man doing this sapper work?
This was we were ordered to. That's where I was trained as an assault engineer, and it was experience for the Assault Pioneers to get to work in. This is the first time we could get back to do some pioneering. Like, that's their job, is for Assault Pioneers is to dig trenches and build defences and build sleeping quarters and put water supplies in. And purification works and all that. They do all that. We are like a sapper, a regimental sapper sort of thing. And I was the only B2 engineer in the battalion. Me and my boys were B3s.
But why have a sapper infantry unit when the RE could do that themselves?
Well, there's not enough. There's not enough. Every battalion has a sapper platoon, if you can call them a sapper, Assault Pioneer platoon. And he's allowed to have a beard. If you saw the photograph in there, I've got a beard on in there. You get permission off the colonel and he says, yes, you go ahead. And you're the only man in the battalion allowed to wear a beard.
And this was at Bucket Knuckle?
Yeah, a little village called Bucket Knuckle.
What were the main problems that you had at that time?
Well, there was at that particular time, there was no great problem there. We came back to Sabah and we were given a week's leave, and then we went with the battalion to Sarawak again. And the Assault Pioneer was split up into three with the three companies, A, B, C company. So there was like so many pioneers to each company to do all them sort of jobs, whether it was minefields or there wasn't many minefields there, of course, but anything to do with sapper work. And I was with A company. A Major Arnott was in charge at A company. And the job I had there was, if there was any patrols going out, Major Arnott liked me to have me with them. Because if we came across a landing strip, he would want me to make sure it was clear of any booby traps or anything like that before he put his men in on it. So I was always with him, with my box of tricks of switches and fuses and things like that. And the big one of the whole of the year was this particular patrol. We went on this patrol and took up a position, an ambush position. And we were told by intelligence that there was a fortified village further down, and there were irregular soldiers, which were usually Chinese mercenaries or something like that. We were told they were irregulars. And these were the people we were after. So we thought we will try an ambush on them. So we laid ambush, and we sent a party off to the left of us and created a firefight, hoping that would cause these people to walk into our ambush to investigate. And it never happened. So we sat in ambush position all night, and nothing came. Except, just before it got dark, a man, one of the natives, collecting durian fruit. He was I don't know if you've seen durian fruit. It stinks like hell when it falls. But they love durian fruit, great big things. And he was collecting these, and he fell into our trap. He didn't see us there. He fell onto us. And I also remember he had a big goiter on his ear, and he was on his neck, and he was terrified. And we had to calm him down and tell him he was all right, and give him little tidbits of sweets and what we had in our pockets, and explain to him that once we finish, you can go home, like, you know. Oh, yeah. So he was quite happy to go along with us, sitting there with us all night. So when dawn came, still nothing had happened. Nobody had come into our killing area. And Major Arnott says, "Murray, I want you to go down to the village." Because there's a village on our left as well. He says, "And I want you to, there's two longhouses there. There's one unoccupied longhouse, and there's one a disused longhouse. So he says, I want you to go down, set fire to that disused longhouse." He says, "That'll fetch them to investigate. You think we've set fire to it and moved out." So I went down there, and I had a 3-minute ground flare, what they use on airports, you know, to guide the, they put either side of the truck to bring them down at night. I had this ground flare, and I just lit the ground flare and went along the eaves of the atap roof, like, and it went up in no time. And we'd no sooner got back into position when the enemy, we barely settled down, and the enemy were coming in, and our lads were all there waiting, you see. And we had a device, like a radio type of device, which was quite a simple thing. It was just a matter of rubbing two wires together. So the man on the way with a linear ambush, you've got them all laid out in ambush, looking over a clearance where you've got a good view of fire, field of fire. And then you have stops on the right-hand side. Two men were called stops on the right-hand side, and two men were called stops on the left-hand side, so they can catch anybody going out or coming in, whatever. And the man on the right-hand side, he's telling you by rubbing this wire together, which the earphones in the officer's ear, he can tell how many's coming into the killing area. And I think we had about 20 in the killing area. And then suddenly this bloke stopped dead, and he come towards the man on the in the stop, and he didn't spot him, but he thought he did, and he was looking into the bush where this bloke was. And we all had American weapons then. We all had Armalite rifles because we were lighter in the jungle, you know, didn't have our old heavy rifles. And this bloke couldn't hang on any longer. He just opened up and he'd lost his bottle, and he let him have the full mag. And when the first shot's fired, everybody fires then. Well, so 20 odd men just went down as quick as that, and they're all jumping around like writhing about sort of thing. And then one of our lads got shot. We didn't see where it came from, but he was shot and took his chest out. Lad, I think it was Greer, I'm not sure, Greer. So I can't remember his name now. And four people bent down to pick him up, and a grenade exploded and shot the four of them all, shrapnel, all, they all got shrapnel up the arse. And that was our total wounded, one dead and four wounded. And so there was more to come, but besides having the stops on either side, we had Claymore mines, one pointing that way and one pointing that way. Where a Claymore mine has, is a concave, is that the concave shape?
Yeah.
And it's a matrix full of ball bearings, 700 steel balls with 1.5 pound of explosive behind it. And it's on legs, like scissor type legs, and you can sight it down the truck where you want it to explode. So once this attack went in, people were responsible for initiating that mine, you know. And so 700 steel balls went shooting up the truck that way, if anybody was going that way, and 700 steel balls flying down the truck that way. And then the idea of an ambush then is to get out and get out quick. So we pulled out, and we had to get the wounded and the dead, so we called in a helicopter, and we had to cut trees down to make a hole in the canopy and set off a yellow flare to guide the helicopter in. And at the same time, we were covering, doing a rear guard action on the troops that were left that were coming to try and get their own back, sort of thing. But anyhow, we did. We managed to. They wouldn't take the dead man. They took the wounded man, but the pilot wouldn't take the dead man. So I had to tie him onto a homemade stretcher, similar to the ones we did in Kenya. And we had to carry him back. The whole company had to take turns carrying him back to base. And the steps, the way back, we called it Slanchan. They were 6 foot, like giant stairs, 6 foot drop and then 6 foot, 6 foot down. It was easy coming down, but getting back up there with a dead body, God, we had to change every few yards to get a break, you know, to get that dead body and ourselves and our kit back up there. And that was the ambush, the ambush of the biggest action of the whole battalion, and I was in on that, which I thought was well executed.
Where and when would that ambush have been?
It was on the borders of Sarawak.
Anywhere near Bukit Knuckle?
No, miles away. That was miles away from there. What did you call it? Balai Ringan was our headquarters. Balai Ringan was the company battalion headquarters. Plaman Mapu was one of the posts. And what was the other post? Called after a palm tree. I can't remember the name of it now. Yeah.
And do you know roughly the date of that ambush?
No, I couldn't tell you now. Well, it would be the 1964, I think. 64 or beginning of 65. It was near towards...